Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Well, the 2018 draft has come and gone. Over the course of 3 days, teams drafted 1,204 prospective farmhands, with signings beginning over the course of subsequent days. Were there any draft surprises?
I think there are always going to be at least a few draft surprises, especially in a draft that is so expansive. But one thing that immediately jumps out is Brady Singer falling to 18. The Royals at pick 18. I think Fangraphs had him slotted around third overall, and I think other places had him roughly around the same in the top 10 area. So he definitely slipped a little. And I think that is probably due to a number of factors. But Keith Law reported that some teams valued him as a starter, while others thought that he would be more of a reliever. So that's probably the thing that really allowed him to slip down to number 18.
Yeah, that one was definitely a surprise, like watching the first round and, you know, all these other guys keep getting picked before him. And I'm like, what happened to Brady Singer? He must be feeling so stressed out right now, poor guy. But one person who did go in the top 10 that was kind of surprising was Kyler Murray. He is likely going to be the Oklahoma Sooners starting quarterback this coming fall. And the A's selected him 9th overall. And it's not like it's unheard of for two sport athletes to get drafted, but the fact that he went so early was a surprise because he was planning to play football in the fall, and he had like pretty much immediately was like, yeah, I'm going to play football this fall. And he and the A's did manage to come to a deal where he signs with them for nearly $5 million because this slot is, I think it's valued at $4.7 million. But while he has that contract, he's still allowed to play football at Oklahoma this fall. He has 2 years of eligibility left, so he won't get to play his senior year, but he will get to play this season like he was planning to. So I guess it's sort of a compromise that way. And part of why this whole situation's weird is because it's highlighted some sort of weird NCAA rules. Because, you know, we all know how the NCAA is about college athletes and making money off of their own image. But there's a rule that allows college athletes who play in one sport to play professionally in another sport, which, sure, I mean, it's that itself isn't a bad thing. What's bad is that, you know, athletes can't make money off of their own name in their own sport. Like this case brought up the situation of Donald DeLay from UCF, who I guess had a YouTube channel and had monetized videos on it, and the videos played ads of him, and so he like lost his NCAA eligibility because of that. And he like tweeted about how, oh, why can Kyler Murray do this but I couldn't have my YouTube channel? And like, he has a point, but also the rules are such that guys like Kyler Murray can do this, and you know, we saw it with Russell Wilson too. So it's just kind of a reminder of the weirdness, I guess, of the NCAA and the fact that there are some guys out there who are good enough to play at the, you know, D1 collegiate level in one sport and also play professionally in another sport. So, yeah, that to sum it all up, that was a surprise for a number of reasons, but mainly because he went so high in the draft. I think we were all kind of not expecting that one.
Yeah, that just reminds me of this story of multi-sport athlete from Stanford named Tyler Gaffney. He was drafted not as early. He was in the 24th round of the 2012 draft, and he by the Pirates. He played in like 38 games before at the end of the season he went back to playing football at Stanford, and it's completely allowed because you're only allowed to go professional in one sport, and it's not considered going pro in the same sport. So if he was going to go back to Stanford, he could not play baseball, obviously. But then the thing that's interesting with Gaffney is that he played for multiple NFL teams, but now he's back playing professional baseball. So go figure.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird situation all around that, as Sarah was saying, kind of really highlights the inconsistencies within the NCAA rules regarding player compensation and all of that stuff. And it's just kind of like a weird thing to like play one more year of football and then go into baseball, especially when he's not going to get compensated for that year of playing football. It just seems like an odd choice, but I guess, I mean, if he loves football and baseball, you know, why not? And then another sort of surprising thing, I guess this isn't super surprising, but it is, you know, just kind of an overall trend that's really surprising, which is Brian Rollison, who was drafted in the first round by the Rockies, tweeted many years ago on the night of the 2012 election that, you know, it wasn't too late for somebody to shoot then-President Obama. And that tweet was still up on his account. And obviously, people found it quite quickly as soon as he was drafted, because that's just how Twitter works. And at this point, it just seems very surprising that players don't lock their accounts or you know, completely wipe their accounts clean as soon as they know that they're going to enter the draft.
Yeah, you think by now we've seen enough how this can, if not ruin a career, can definitely like mar a career. And it just seems like something that's so easy to avoid. But, you know, maybe we're getting to the point where kids are coming up and getting into social media kind of with the knowledge that this is something that's going to follow them for their entire lives, because we've seen enough evidence of it. So I'm thinking this is a trend that is going to become less common going forward, but nonetheless still is very much a thing. You know, wasn't like Rollison's tweets were like exceptionally awful, but people of course found others. There was Chad Moriyama of Dodgers Digest in The Athletic had a tweet that cracked me up, because with one of the Dodgers draft picks, they couldn't find anything bad on his profile. And so he was like, "Oh, all hail our unproblematic king." And yeah, I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much what it comes down to. Like, you know, just as long as there's nothing like questionable on there, like you're basically our unproblematic king now. So it's a very low bar, I guess, that has been set for these prospects, yet some still can't seem to figure it out. So I guess the other thing that I would mention as being not a surprise necessarily from the draft, but just kind of a fun thing, is it's always fun to see the kids of famous parents getting drafted. Sometimes it's athletes like Cody Clemens, who of course is the son of Roger Clemens. He got picked by the Tigers in the third round. Then there was Tommy Wilson, who is the son of Tom Wilson, who played Biff Tannen in Back to the Future. And he was taken by the Mets in the 19th round. So I'm sure he'll have fun with all of the references that will be made on his behalf. But, you know, he might also be used to that by now. And then the other one that kind of stood out to me was Cannon King, who was the son of Larry King. Because, yes, Larry King named his son Cannon. He was selected by the White Sox in the 37th round. And this actually isn't the first one of Larry King's kids to get drafted. His other son, Chance, which, yeah, Larry King's sons are named Chance and Cannon. That's a thing. Yeah, he was also picked by the White Sox last year, but he did not sign. So, you know, we'll see if it's the same for Cannon. But yeah, just kind of fun to see kids come up and then people be like, oh, wait, their parents are famous. So, yeah, that's always entertaining for me.
Yeah, same. It's always really interesting to see all of the different connections that people dig up. Like Tom Wilson, I don't think would be one that would immediately spring to mind. People generally look more toward former players themselves and their children. So that's just a really kind of interesting and more obscure one that popped up. And the poor guy is really, I mean, it's going to be a long road for him, you know, with the internet immediately kind of latching on to the fact that he is Biff's son. And then, of course, it's just kind of weird for Larry King that he has sons that are this young. I know he has, like, many wives and many kids, but, like, it's just weird.
It's so weird. He's, like, 80-something, and these kids are, like, 20, and I'm like, oh, my God, you're so old, and your kids are so young. He's 84, oh, my God. Like, no judgment, but also, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I will say that Cannon King is such a baseball name.
It is. But also, yeah. You're an 84-year-old yeah. Jewish guy from Brooklyn, and your kid's name is Cannon King.
I'm pretty sure he has grandkids that are older than his kids.
That's such a weird dynamic.
Yep.
Well, good luck to Cannon King and all the others. Not that they need it that much, but, you know, they're set for life. But, yeah, good luck to them anyway. So moving on, there were some prominent injuries to starting pitchers this week. To name a few, Steven Strasburg left two innings into his start on Friday and was placed on the DL Saturday when an MRI revealed shoulder inflammation. Masahiro Tanaka hit the disabled list with strains in both of his hamstrings on Saturday. Noah Syndergaard got scratched ahead of his scheduled Sunday start when he experienced finger swelling and discomfort after playing catch. And then there was Shohei Ohtani hitting the disabled list with a grade 2 UCL strain. Per the Angels, Ohtani underwent a PRP and stem cell injection on Thursday with Dr. Steve Yoon in Los Angeles, and he will be reevaluated in 3 weeks, and then they will update us on his plan of care at that time. As Bill Shaken of the LA Times noted, Ohtani would not be the first Angels pitcher to undergo this treatment. Both Garrett Richards and Andrew Heaney tried it, with Richards managing to avoid Tommy John, but Heaney not being able to, which, you know, you don't like putting it in those terms necessarily, but that's just kind of what the situation is. Ohtani has previously undergone PRP treatment, and his physical upon signing with the Angels revealed UCL damage. Considering that, how much of a surprise is this news?
I don't think it's that much of a surprise. People seem to be expecting something like this to happen. Maybe not, you know, this early in his career, but certainly at some point. Particularly, you know, with the troubles that he's had in the past. But also, it just seems like pitchers are ripe for getting these kinds of injuries, as is, even without his injury history. So it's not that surprising. And just, I think everybody's kind of hoping that the injections that he got will be enough to fix his UCL without having to undergo Tommy John surgery.
Yeah, I can't say that I'm entirely surprised, considering that the physical upon signing, you know, revealed that he had some UCL damage. I am disappointed because Ohtani is just, you know, been a delight to watch. That being said, I just hope that he's able to have full recovery because, you know, Ohtani's young. He has been a new force in the game that needed new life this way. So I'm just really hoping that he doesn't necessarily return to baseball when he shouldn't be returning, but making a full recovery. That way there might not be as many problems but pop up in the future.
Yeah, I think disappointed but not surprised is the best way to put it, which, you know, usually that means something different. But in this case, it really is just, you know, this is something that, you know, you might have known was, like, you didn't know it was coming necessarily, but, like, just given the history, like, yeah, it makes perfect sense. But nonetheless, you really, really hope that it wasn't going to be the case. And, yeah, like you guys said, you know, just really hope that he can make a full recovery. Hopefully it won't require surgery. But, you know, we'll know more in 3 weeks' time.
I wonder, like, if it ends up requiring surgery, like, what would happen to him? Because he's such a valuable hitter as well. Do you think that there might be a possibility that he would just focus on hitting instead of pitching so that he doesn't miss so much playing time?
I mean, one of the reasons why he signed with the Angels is because they were the only team, from what I could gather, that actually gave him the opportunity to both pitch and hit. So I think if one goes, so does the other. So I think he's going to do what's in the best interest of his pitching as well as his hitting, because you know it is totally possible for hitters to get Tommy John as well, so it might also be something that could affect his swing.
Yeah, it's hard for me to see him, you know, giving up pitching if, you know, the situation is that he requires surgery, which hopefully doesn't come to that, but, you know, it's hard to say at this point. You know, it, obviously the recovery from Tommy John surgery is different for pitchers and position players, although of course Ohtani's not really a position player so much. When he hits, it's mostly as the designated hitter, but yeah, so if he were to decide, okay, I can get back faster if I treat my recovery as if I was not a pitcher, you know, I don't think he would, you know, be willing to take those like few extra months or whatever that he gets back, or the like maybe slightly less strenuous rehab process that comes with it. I think, like Jen said, you know, pitching is something really important to him, and I think for the Angels, they, you know, he's been such a huge part of their rotation, and it's just hard for me to see him being willing to give that up for, you know, maybe a slightly quicker return.
In other injury news, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Today has been diagnosed with a strained patellar tendon in his left knee. The Jays plan to monitor the situation closely and reevaluate him in 4 weeks. Hopefully he won't need much more time than that and will be able to return in July to continue his phenomenal play.
Elsewhere in baseball, Jose Torres of the Padres was suspended 100 games for violating MLB's domestic violence policy. He was arrested in December of 2017 and charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and criminal damage, according to the Maricopa County Superior Court. Torres has accepted the 100-game suspension, which is retroactive to June 5th. This is the first suspension of this magnitude to be issued under the domestic violence policy, with the previous longest being Hector Olivera's 82 games. An article from the San Diego Union-Tribune from February of this year states, Padres reliever Jose Torres was arrested in December after a dispute in which he allegedly brandished a semi-automatic handgun. The incident occurred in the home Torres shares with his wife in Phoenix and is being handled as a domestic violence case, according to court documents. According to the probable cause statement contained in the court report, Torres knocked a door off its hinges and punched a hole in another door. He also pointed the gun at the victim, according to the report. Admittedly, this story escaped our notice here at THT Audio at the time it originally happened. While we understand it would be redundant to cover every DV incident in depth, we try to at least make note of incidents when they occur, and we think it's worth discussing why this story might have flown under our radar. The initial coverage of the arrest was relegated to more Maricopa County coverage, with SportsSize reporting on the story in mid-February once it was announced that Torres was placed on the Padres' restricted list. Many headlines simply stated that he was placed on the restricted list, omitting the fact that it was for DV charges. How much of the headline matters, and what should publications reporting on the matter have done differently?
I mean, headlines matter so much for so many readers. It's going to be the only thing that they see. And if they just see a guy was placed on the restricted list, they might not investigate further. And maybe if you're a Padres fan, you might want to find out why this guy isn't going to be able to play for you for however much time, or get more information about that. But for most people, they're just going to see, oh, this guy that I don't really know much about is on the restricted list. I probably don't care that much about it. Whereas if you include why he's on the restricted list in the headline, that is going to stick with people. You know, I understand that for some sites, length is an issue when it comes to headlines, and you know, try to put in what you can to get the point across while also staying within the constraints of the character limit. But nonetheless, this is the lead here. The fact that he pulled a gun on his wife. It's not the fact that he's on the restricted list. So I feel like the story is more the arrest than the restricted list part of it. But I guess you do also kind of understand, like, sites are outlets that are more focused specifically on sports, choosing to highlight the restricted list part, just, you know, focusing on sort of the transactional part of it rather than the actual incident itself. But it would make a huge difference if readers, you know, just see in the headline, you know, this is why this guy was on the restricted list rather than having to go to the article to click, because most people aren't going to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that publications just need to be aware of the fact that domestic violence is the main element here, and they need to understand how they should approach that subject, and how it goes beyond just the transactional elements or the day-to-day baseball story, and it impacts the larger community. It impacts, you know, society as a whole, and they need to be responsible for that.
I agree with everything that's been said, and I think as well, when promoting stories on social media, it doesn't have to be the same as a headline. Oftentimes you see newspapers and other publications just listing out, you know, the same headline. But I think, you know, especially with the longer character limit on Twitter now, I think it would have been possible to, you know, unbury the lead and put it in the promotional stuff on social media, because it's possible. I think it's just something that has not caught up with news organizations and many publications as a whole. So with all of that being said, it's pretty hard to ignore a 100-game suspension. Is this a satisfactory punishment for an incident like Torres's?
I think it's, on one hand, it's difficult to answer that because we don't fully know what the situation is. But on the other hand, I don't think a suspension is ever going to be enough in instances like this. I think that it's so much more about just not allowing a player to take the field. I think obviously it does speak to the severity of this incident that the suspension is so large, the largest that Major League Baseball has ever given out, particularly when a recent trend seems to be smaller suspensions, you know, not even approaching the 50-game mark. So to see it so high, I think, really speaks to just how severe this is, and it kind of says that there should be more done.
I don't want to say it's nice to see it, but I guess it's refreshing in a way to see that, you know, it's a longer suspension than, you know, players get for PED offenses. You know, we always sort of compare the two, like, oh, why are performance enhancing drugs treated more seriously than incidents of domestic violence? But in this case, you know, we are getting a suspension that is greater than, you know, suspensions that we've seen recently for PEDs. Of course, that's only for violating the policy after the original offense. And again, we don't really know what he did to violate the policy after the fact. But it's, you know, like Mary was saying, a suspension on its own is probably not enough in actuality. And obviously, there's got to be some sort of rehabilitation process that happens. Like, you know, there's got to be some sort of training that happens. It's got to be more than just a punishment, but it definitely does send a message that it is the largest ever suspension for this particular thing, and that is something that is definitely good to see. It's definitely on the right track, though. On its own, it's probably not enough.
Yeah, I agree with everything. I think with suspensions, there has to be more done. It can't just be a suspension. I believe that, you know, there has to be some kind of education process, and it should be administered by someone whose focus is working with those who have been through DV, and the focus especially being on the safety of the victim. I think that there should be a better education process when it comes to that in Major League Baseball. It's also important to note that this is an ongoing case in Maricopa County Superior Court. Torres is scheduled to have a pretrial conference with a judge on June 18th, with a trial happening on July 2nd. Now, our Twitter questions.
All right, our first question comes from a friend of the podcast, Lauren, who is at LLW90210. If a Phillies first baseman breaks a bat on a hit, are the shards most accurately called Reese's Pieces?
Lauren, I love you.
And I think the only answer is yes. Obviously, that's what they're called.
There's no other name that they could go by, and I really hope that that happens and this catches on, because it is pure brilliance.
Also, that would make an amazing fantasy baseball team name.
Yeah, if no one's jumped on that, I don't play fantasy baseball, so I don't have any place judging people for not choosing a name, but I'm definitely judging people if no one's used that.
I think you're going to be judging a lot of people, because I have not seen anyone yet use this name. It has not appeared on any sort of fantasy baseball team name list that I've seen, so judge away.
Yeah, the first thing that comes up when I search Reese's Pieces is some guy named Reese, who's not Reese Hoskins, has a blog called Reese's Pieces. So that's, yeah, I guess someone else has claimed it, but like, it should be, I feel like it should be reserved for Reese Hoskins, just IMO.
I agree.
Completely agree.
And this guy hasn't even blogged since like 2013 or whatever, so.
Wow. Well, now now he's forfeited it. That's just how it works.
So this is another question from Lauren. Which teams did we think were contenders in the offseason should sell at the trade deadline?
I feel like that's sort of a difficult question to answer, because so many divisions have been so weird. And I would say that there aren't too many huge contenders that are, out of the playoff race at this point in the season. I think that the only one that's kind of concerning is the Dodgers. And even then, they're still very much in it. Of course, we'll have to see how all of the injuries play out for them. But at this point in time, I don't know if there are any teams that we thought would be big contenders at the beginning of the season that, you know, aren't at least in the race.
Yeah, I think the only team that sort of jumped out at me was the Twins. I think some people thought that they would have a chance at, you know, probably a wild card again. And they have not been playing so well. They're currently at 27-34. And they're also in, like the Dodgers, they're also in a division that's pretty weak compared to some of the others. The AL Central has not been that great so far this season. But I also don't really see them catching up with Cleveland. So they're kind of the only ones that stand out as a team that we thought maybe had a shot at competing that I don't think I have that much confidence in to turn things around.
I don't know who they would be trading away, because they have such a young team.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Like, are they going to sell off Joe Mauer? I don't, probably not. He's been hurt. I don't know.
The only team that I would say I didn't think that they would be a contender, but I know that there were some people out there thinking that this could be a return to contention, especially with what year it is. But I think the Giants should sell at the trade deadline, and I'm not just saying this because I hate my team. I think that it's gotten to the point where they really should just look at a rebuild.
Yeah, that's probably in their best interest. Although they've been better than I think most people expect them to be.
Yeah, they're at 500. That in the NL West, that's good.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely looking at the norm in the division, they are doing a lot better than expected. But it's also gone to the point where I just don't want to see Jeff Smarja keep getting on the DL anymore. And I know, you know, with Madison Bumgarner's return, that will probably make them a little bit more competitive than they were. It's definitely much more of an upside than Smarja, but they are still the Giants after all, and I don't care about this even year nonsense. I want it to end.
Preach.
Baseball's fun, we promise.
I promise I don't actually hate my team as much. No, I actually do hate my team as much as I say I do.
It's the relationship that we have with teams is, it's a bizarre one. The teams that we claim to be our favorites are usually the ones that cause us the most agony. So, you know, it's a totally healthy relationship.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Our final Twitter question comes from John at John Emilianoff. What's up with players wearing big gold necklaces with their uniform?
Okay. So I think this question is saying a lot more than it thinks it is. I think that there's nothing wrong with players wearing giant necklaces on their around their neck, even if they, you know, might at times fall off or break or whatever, and then you have the weird like searching through the dirt for diamonds and whatnot. I think that it's totally fine for players to do that. And I think that there are so many non-white players, particularly Latin American players, who wear these necklaces. And it's just kind of, a cultural thing or whatever. And so I think that we need to be careful when we, you know, make questions like this. We need to think about everything that is going into them, all of the elements, and we need to really understand what we're saying.
Yeah, very much so. You know, you consider the trends of, you know, baseball fashion, I guess is the term. You know, you think about, okay, who are the demographics generally that we see wearing these? And, you know, maybe there's a reason why it tends to go along these lines. But that said, there's so many players who also wear like big crosses when they pitch, you know, like their religion's important to them and they choose to show that by, you know, wearing a piece of jewelry that demonstrates that. And, you know, it's people have all kinds of reasons for the way that they choose to style themselves and express themselves. And I don't know. I'm like, as long as it doesn't bother you while you're playing that, then I don't really care. Like, do what you want, wear what you want. I mean, like, it's hard for me to imagine like running while wearing a big chain, but like, that's me. I'm like, me on like the elliptical for half an hour is not the same as like a player on the field. Like, things are very different for them. They, you know, they know what they're doing. And it's, yeah, I mean, it may not seem like something that is super practical, but if they found a way to make it work, then, you know, good for them. They feel good. They look good. Or they feel that they look good. Like, yeah, I don't really see what harm it does.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said about how there's been a lack of personal expression in baseball, especially with, you know, the whole cleats thing going on. I think that baseball should continue to have its individuality in any way possible, whether that be through cleats or little things written on their hat or in eye black, as long as it's not offensive to anyone. I think just this whole policing of a person's individuality and ways that they express themselves is kind of tired. it's getting to the point where it's just not cool anymore. Not that it ever was.
Yeah, I mean, basically let the players wear whatever they want, as long as it doesn't impede their playing, or as long as it's not offensive. You know, allow them to express themselves. It's a long season. It's, you know, they're human beings. They have personalities. Let them show it off. It makes it better for the players and better for the fans.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at Sarah Wexler 32. You can find Mary at Miriam Craig, and you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.